Committee to order. We have a very, very full agenda today, so I would just ask that everyone make their comments as brief as possible, and to let you all know that we will hold the record for this issue open until 5 o'clock tomorrow. And if you have written testimony to back up any of your oral testimony, you can deliver it to my office, to Senator Byer's office, the Vice Chair of Senate Judiciary, or to the Judiciary Committee office, and it will be included in the record. So with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 2 adds sexual orientation, which is already a protected characteristic under Oregon's hate crime statutes, to several statutes that prohibit discrimination based on religion, age, race, color, sex, national origin, and marital status. The bill defines sexual orientation to mean an individual's actual or perceived heterosexuality, homosexuality, bisexuality, or gender identity, regardless of whether the individual's gender identity, appearance, expression, or behavior differs from that traditionally associated with the individual's sex at birth. SB 2 establishes that a person may not discriminate based on an individual's sexual orientation with regard to employment, housing, public accommodations, public services, public education, adult foster homes, and foster parenting, among other things. The bill declares that the opportunity to obtain employment, housing, and the use and enjoyment of public accommodations free of discrimination based on sexual orientation or religion, age, race, color, sex, national origin, or marital status is a civil right. It allows an individual who has suffered discrimination based on sexual orientation to bring a civil action for injunctive relief, damages, and attorney's fees. The bill permits churches or other religious institutions to take actions based on sexual orientation with respect to employment, housing, or the use of public accommodations if the religious institution, one, has a bona fide religious belief about sexual orientation, and two, the employment, housing, or use of facilities in question is closely connected with or related to the primary purposes of the church or institution, and is not connected with a commercial or business activity that has no necessary relationship to the institution or the institution's primary purpose. SB 2 allows employers to enforce valid dress codes and policies if the employer provides reasonable accommodations when necessitated by the health and safety needs of the individual. The bill also repeals ORS 236.380, which prohibits state officials from forbidding the taking of personnel actions against any state employee based on sexual orientation.
Thank you. We have two guest members of our panel today. On my right is Senator Avakian, and on my left is Senator Bates, who doesn't have a nameplate, but he's still Senator Bates. And we will start, before we get into our panels today, we will start off with testimony from Senator Rick Metzger so he can get back to the committee that he chairs.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and co-sponsor of Senate Bill 500 with the chair. It's a pleasure to be here today. Today we are faced with the responsibility of making a very, very important statement for our citizens, a statement that will ask us if we can say at this time to our brothers and our sisters, our friends, and our neighbors, that this state does, in fact, affirm the most unalienable of rights, and that's the right to justice, compassion, and equality for all of our citizens. Words are important, and in these two documents that we have before us today, Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500, those words articulate a very, very important statement that we are about to make, I hope, for the citizens of Oregon, and that is that discrimination has no place in Oregon life or Oregon law. Now, men and women of good faith and compassion can disagree about the different course of action we may take, but as I am often reminded, no one has a patent on righteousness. These are moral documents, but of what morality do we subscribe? Is it moral to deny someone a job simply because they're gay? Is it moral to deny someone a home in our neighborhood, or services in a place of public accommodation because of their sexual orientation? And if so, then who of us would stand in their shoes? And who of us would like to be relegated to the place of second-class citizens? No one has asked the guardsman who was left bleeding on the streets of Fallujah or Tikrit whether they were gay before we asked them to come and defend our families overseas. You know, no one asked the heart surgeon or the firefighter or the policeman about their sexual orientation when we call them to help us in a life or death situation. Can we then, as citizens of this state, deny them the same respect and dignity and security for their families? I believe it's time to make a commitment, a long overdue commitment, to justice and equality for all of our citizens. And it's time to put away the mythology that has fostered social injustice. Either of these bills will make that statement. And I commend them to you and ask for swift action so that our state can make that affirmation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Metzger? Thank you. Okay, now we will move into our panels. I'm going to give a half hour for the proponents and a half hour for the opponents. This has been previously arranged through my office and through Senator Byer's office. And after that part of the panel, we will alternate between proponents and opponents. Looking at the sign-up list, we are really going to be crunched for time. So the quicker you are, we will impose a two-minute limit on people after the panels so that everybody hopefully can get done. Now, we will be reconvening this hearing this afternoon at 5:30 in Hearing Room E. And so anyone who doesn't get a chance to testify today will have another opportunity at 5:30. So with that, we will start our first panel, Paul Kelly, Annabelle Jaramillo, Reverend Jean Ross, Dan Gardner, and Lane Shetterly.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Senators Zavakian and Bates. My name is Paul Kelly. I live in Portland, where I also practice law part-time, I guess, with the law firm Garvey, Schubert & Bearer. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of Senate Bill 2. I'm here primarily in my role as chair of the Governor's Task Force on Equality, and I'm joined by two of my fellow task force members. On my right, Annabelle Jaramillo, who is a Benton County Commissioner, and Reverend Eugene Ross on my left, a minister of the United Church of Christ in Portland. It'll be our privilege today to introduce you to the task force, its work, and the task force report, which I see is being distributed to you now. Since I'll refer to that task force report frequently in my remarks, I'd like to incorporate it into the testimony today. And I might add that of the two recommendations that the task force reports, it is the first recommendation that we are here to address today. But both recommendations were made unanimously by this task force to the governor. So addressing the first of those two recommendations, it's very straightforward. The task force recommended to the governor that it should be the public policy of the state of Oregon to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. As you undoubtedly know, the governor created this task force by Executive Order 0603 in February 2006. He appointed 11 members to the task force, bringing together a variety of experience from business, religious, and civic communities around the state. The task force was charged by the governor with a specific task that appears on the first and second pages of the report. I'll only refer briefly to it, but I think the first of the series of findings in the governor's executive order is as follows, and I quote, "Equal protection under the law is the cornerstone of a just and democratic society." The governor then charged the task force with analyzing current law, considering whether changes are needed in order to guarantee that all Oregonians are protected adequately from discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in employment, housing, public accommodations, and other opportunities. The report itself identifies the other eight members of the task force and provides some biographical information on them. Now, a bit about the task force's work, which I think is important to the background of the recommendations, so you receive them not in a vacuum, but in context. In addition to receiving substantial public testimony on the topics within the governor's charge, which I'll refer to in a moment, task force explored several relevant areas in order to educate ourselves on the issue of discrimination. For example, Oregon Department of Justice expertly advised us on a number of legal aspects of our inquiry, including Oregon constitutional and statutory provisions and relevant judicial decisions. We reviewed existing local ordinances prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation and similar proposed legislation introduced in the 2005 session of this legislature. The Bureau of Labor and Industries, through the good graces of Commissioner Gardner, fully briefed the task force on current state and local anti-discrimination laws and their enforcement. By both Boley and our courts, the committee did additional research on legal developments both at the federal level and among the several states. I should note, by the way, that currently there are 17 states that have laws that provide some degree of protection against discrimination based on sexual orientation. Task force met in open session between April and the end of November. In addition to those regular meetings, the task force broke into subcommittees and scheduled four meetings around the state for the express purpose of giving the public an opportunity to comment on the topics before us. Those meetings were held in Portland, Medford, Bend, and Lincoln City during the month of September. For those meetings, we announced them in advance publicly. They were covered in the media. We also issued letters of invitation to a number of business, religious, and civic leaders in those four communities to present to the task force. We also extended an invitation to the Oregon Family Council and arranged a special presentation opportunity for the Oregon Family Council, and three members of that group, in fact, testified at some length before the task force. With the exception of the testimony presented to the task force by the Oregon Family Council, all of the testimony presented to us by over 100 Oregonians was in favor of the enactment of this kind of legislation. We heard compelling personal stories from citizens who have experienced discrimination because of their sexual orientation. Several business representatives who testified during the course of these hearings essentially echoed a spokesman from Nike who said that fully respecting gay and lesbian employees helped to make Nike an employer of choice, furthering the company's goal of attracting the best and brightest employees. I should add that a number of businesses which presented to the task force in fact operate in one of the 12 local jurisdictions, cities or counties around the state, that have ordinances prohibiting sexual discrimination. Those include, for example, Portland, Bend, Beaverton, and nine others. None of those business representatives who presented to us indicated any negative impact on their businesses, on their employee recruitment, from the fact that they were operating within local jurisdictions that already prohibited discrimination based on sexual orientation. Rather than take too much of the committee's time reciting specific examples, however, permit me to refer you to the task force report, which gives you some more detail on the testimony presented. And I'd also invite you, although rather time-consuming if you were to undertake it, to review some of the extensive testimony that was presented, all of which is part of the record. It's referred to in the appendices to this report and is available in or through the governor's office. In light of the fact that the Oregon Family Council spoke in opposition to the adoption of this legislation, I'd like to briefly address what I at least understood to be two of their key points of concern or objection. One was that they felt there was no real need for legislation prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation. And that view seemed to be that essentially gays and lesbians were well integrated into our communities, were successful, profitable, productive citizens, and therefore there was no need for this kind of legislation. Their second point was really, I think, a request in the context of the possible passage of such legislation that there be included a religious exemption. So if I respond briefly to the first of their objections, the experience of this task force and the clear weight of the testimony that was presented to us, as well as the other evidence presented to this task force, I think I can say summarily that our conclusion is not the same as the Oregon Family Council's in terms of the need for anti-discrimination legislation. It is still clear that gays and lesbians suffer the scourge of discrimination, unfortunately, both in this state and elsewhere around the country. Our report outlines in greater detail some of the judicial decisions, both here in Oregon, in our sister state to the north, Washington, and elsewhere in the country, reflecting a long and continuing history of prejudice against gays and lesbians. I might note, as I just said, it is still legal in Oregon, other than in the 12 local communities that I mentioned that have ordinances, to fire an employee or fail to promote an employee, to evict a tenant, to deny service in a restaurant solely because of one's disapproval of someone's sexual orientation.
Mr. Kelly, you're 10 minutes into your presentation.
May I take 1 minute to finish, Senator?
It's your panel, so
thank you. Well, thank you.
We'll end after 30 minutes. Be short
in hours. My colleagues just indicated I could finish, and they'll shorten their remarks. Regarding the Oregon Family Council's desire for a religious exemption in this legislation, the task force fully respects that request. We recognize the principles of freedom of religion in both the U.S. and the Oregon Constitution, and an appropriate exemption for faith-based activities is absolutely appropriate. My reading of Senate Bill 2 indicates that the language currently reflects the position of the task force on that point. I will yield to my colleagues, would conclude simply by urging the committee's approval of Senate Bill 2 as a step on the road to equality for gay and lesbian Oregonians. That step is in harmony with Oregon's longstanding and broad public policy of non-discrimination, as reflected in part in ORS Chapter 659A, which reflects among its goals, and I quote, to ensure the human dignity of all people within this state. That step would also create a uniform statewide law and replace the current patchwork of 12 local ordinances. And finally, I guess fortuitously, I'd say that the Oregonian perhaps said it best in its lead editorial this morning when it concluded by saying, and I quote, it's time to treat gays and lesbians as true equals, our customers, our colleagues, our friends, ourselves, close quote. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for this opportunity to speak about this fundamental American goal of equality.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly, and thank you and your task force for your hard work on this issue.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Senator Bergen. Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Annabelle Hanamio. I'm Benton County Commissioner. I, too, want to thank my colleagues, Paul Kelly and Jane Ross, and all the members of the task force that worked so diligently over an eight-month period to thoroughly look at this issue and then develop the task force report that is before you. Benton County has had a non-discrimination policy, and it was created out of an ordinance that was established in 1998. Our personal policies have updated to reflect those ordinances, and to this date, the sky has not fallen in Benton County. It has been very effective pace of local law. I'd also like to tell you a story of an 8-year-old girl who sat for what seemed like an eternity in the superintendent's office while her mother made the case for desegregating her school. Students at that time were segregated because of the color of their skin being brown and because they had a different language when they first entered school. That first experience with discriminatory practice influenced a lifelong work for fairness. I remember sitting in that superintendent's office and first beginning to understand what difference made and how people judge difference. And that had a unique impact on my life, and it has been my lifelong value that I will not or cannot discriminate against another person simply on the basis of difference or any other factor. It was a very moving experience for me, and it's very personal. There will be those who will tell you that there's no pattern of discrimination, and I think Paul talked about those issues, so I won't go into that further other than to say that you don't need statistics to tell that discrimination exists. Unequal treatment of one is unequal treatment of us all, and I think we need to be aware of that. In the interest of time, I will close, but I will urge you that the time is come, in fact, the time is long overdue, to pass legislation that will prohibit discrimination in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Senator Burdick, Senator Beyer, my name is Eugene Ross. I'm a retired United Church of Christ minister. I've served as a conference minister regionally for the United Church for some 30 years. In that capacity, I worked with family ministries, camping ministries, faith formation for children and youth. And in addition to that, I have been the president of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, which has allowed me to be involved with churches across the theological spectrum. I appreciate this afternoon's opportunity to be with you. I was very appreciative of the opportunity to serve with a great group of distinguished panelists as we worked on this issue. During the 30 years of my ministry, as I moved out amongst the communities, I heard again and again pain and fear coming from my brothers and sisters in the faith community as well as in the wider community, brothers and sisters who are gay, lesbian. Those fears, that pain in this country should not be present. My personal conviction, my faith conviction that all persons are of equal dignity is affronted every time I hear discrimination against a person because of his or her sexual preference. And so I'm here this afternoon to speak in favor of this Senate bill to stop that kind of unfairness, that kind of prejudice, that kind of denying persons their full human potential, their full human dignity. I think that it is important that this not be allowed to continue any longer. My own denomination in the 70s passed at our national meeting legislation called upon all of our churches, individuals, clergy, laity, to work for the passage of non-discrimination legislation at the national, state, and local levels. And here we are now in 2007. And that legislation is not present in all places, and it needs to be. And so I would hope that this committee would be supportive of Senate Bill 2 and would work for its passage in the legislative process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today and express my strong support for Senate Bill 2. To me, this bill represents a simple question of providing fair and equitable treatment to all Oregon citizens. But it's also an opportunity for you to make history in a positive way. I remember in 1997, as a member of the Oregon House, where a similar measure passed the Oregon House floor overwhelmingly, 40 yes, 20 no. However, it didn't pass through the Senate. Thankfully, today you have a chance to change that history. The Bureau's enforcement of local ordinances has gone very well and shows the need. We can tell you the stories of discrimination in relation to these ordinances. Since 2000, the Bureau has investigated nearly 300 cases of alleged discrimination based upon sexual orientation. As you know, the discrimination is banned locally in Multnomah and Benton counties, as well as the cities of Ashland, Beaverton, Bend, Corvallis, Eugene, Lake Oswego, Lincoln City, Portland, and Salem. In addition, Wasco County will be voting on a similar ordinance this month. And, of course, we know that the stats, they don't take into account the cases that go unreported, either because the person experienced discrimination, fears possible retaliation, or because they live outside one of the areas within the local ordinance. Is there anything more unfair than one Oregon citizen being protected while another one living just a few miles away enjoys none of that protection? Indeed, in addition to the cases we investigate, we get a number of calls from people who live in areas with no protection. And we can't do anything for them, even in the most egregious examples of discrimination. In my opinion, this patchwork of local ordinances is also confusing for employers. One consistent statewide law would be better for all citizens of the state. And as you've heard recently, the Governor's Task Force on Equity reiterated the need for this legislation, and I certainly applaud them for their work. In my opinion, there are few votes in the 2007 legislative session that would be more important than this vote on this particular legislation today, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Mr. Shetterly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, appearing here today as a private citizen and former state legislator. I want to thank the chair and this panel for what is really a point of personal privilege to allow me to address the committee on this bill today. Mr. Gardner mentioned a bill with some history 10 years ago. It's hard to believe it was that long ago, but I was a co-sponsor of House Bill 2734 in the 1997 session that really addressed very much what you're looking at in Senate Bill 2 today. It was something that I cut my political teeth on, and at times it felt like I'd cut my political throat on as well, to have co-sponsored that as a freshman legislator in 1997. But I believed in my heart then, and I believe in my heart and my head today, that it was the right thing to do then, and that your passage of Senate Bill 2 today in this session will be the right thing to do now. Dan did indicate the fact that this bill, in its 1997 iteration, almost became law. We really just about did it, but not quite. In the intervening sessions, I think circumstances just have not been propitious to bring this back for a full debate and action. But I think, as we've heard from the panel today, in those intervening years, there has been development at the local level. We've seen local ordinances that have been enacted and successfully administered. And I believe on a national level there's been a change in public attitudes and political attitude toward legislation such as this as well that makes this, again, the right time to bring this bill forward. When I left the legislature in 2004, I had a list of things that I regarded as unfinished business after four sessions, or nine if you count the special sessions of 2002. I'd accomplished a lot as a member, but it was a disappointment to me that this bill yet remained at that time a piece of unfinished business for me. And I made a commitment that no longer being able to vote with you on the floor as colleague for this bill, if ever it came before the legislature again, I would do what I could to address the committee and speak in favor of it, to urge passage. And so it's since, again, I mentioned of personal privilege, but also closure for me as well, to be able to address you and commend this bill to you. Again, as I said, I believed it was the right thing to do then, and I believe that even more so today, and urge your favorable action on Senate Bill 2. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of this panel? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just under page 2 of the bill, subsection 4 of section 3, I'm assuming that that is the religion exemption that Mr. Kelly spoke about, that the Oregon Family Council asked to be put in. Am I correct in reading that?
Was it directed to me, Senator?
Yes, it was.
I believe that's right. I have read all of Senate Bill 2, but I'm afraid I don't have complete mastery of its content. But
I'm
think
sorry.
That is at least one of the places where the religious exemption appears.
Okay, a follow-up, Madam Chair, would be, it says a bona fide church or a sectarian religious institution. Are those defined terms in statute?
I am not sure offhand, Senator, if those are defined. I don't believe so.
Let's see if counsel can address
they're not, that. They're not defined in the statute. I actually did look into that this morning to see if there's even a definition in Oregon case law and didn't see one, but the term bona fide is commonly used in law. It usually refers to sort of authentic, but it's not specifically defined in the statute. So, to answer your question.
Okay. Another question of counsel, Madam Chair.
Please.
I see in this bill you were repealing 236.3A, the statute, and I've got that right in front of us, and I was wondering if counsel has had a chance to review that statute and if you could tell me what sub 2 of that statute really means in non-lawyer terms. It's written in a double negative, and
right.
I'm trying to have a hard time getting my hands around what that statute really says.
Yeah, you're pointing out things that I also looked up this morning. Two states, and I'll read it for the record, and it is a double negative. No state official shall forbid the taking of any personnel action against any state employee based on the sexual orientation of such employee. The way I read 236.380 sub 2 is that a state official cannot forbid somebody else from essentially discriminating based on sexual orientation. When you sort of add up those double negatives, that's where I come to. And I don't see there's, and I look for case law interpreting this provision, and there is none. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. One last question, and again, either for someone from the panel or for counsel, is subsection 5 of section 3, which just follows the one I asked about the bona fide church and sectarian religious institutions. That is seems to be an exemption to that section. Could you explain, I guess, how that will work? That section 5.
Okay, got it. Thanks. Well, subsection 5, I read it in the same way that it limits subsection 4. And the language for the record, subsection 4 of this section applies only if the employment, housing, or the use of facilities is closely connected with or related to the primary purposes of a church or institution and is not connected with a commercial or business activity that has no necessary relationship to the church or institution, comma, or to its primary purposes. So I read it in the same way that it's limiting subsection 4, which broadly states that nothing in the chapter prohibits a bona fide church from taking any action with respect to employment, housing, or the use of facilities based on a bona fide religious belief about sexual orientation. So the way I read this as working is to the extent there is a, you know, an easy example would be a hiring decision that is related to the primary purpose of a church, for example, clergy or possibly at a school or something like that, that would be exempted from the statute. But if it's if there's a commercial or business activity that doesn't have a relationship to the church, then it wouldn't be exempted. And I'm trying to think of an example where that would apply. If a church was maybe investing in something and it wasn't related to the primary purpose, then the religious exemption would not apply. So it would have to be closely connected to what it is the religious institution is doing for this exemption to apply.
Can I offer a possible example? Maybe this would clarify this. Thank you, Madam Chair. There is a church oriented facility in Portland that takes care of elderly people through a assisted living facility and through a nursing home, but are combined on one property, and they also have health care. They receive state and federal funds for that program. It's an exceptional program, does a great job. I would think that they would not be allowed to discriminate against any of those individuals coming into the institute based on sexual orientation. Most of these people are in their 70s and 80s and 90s, but The point being that it's not direct related to their church orientation. They take people from different faiths and different nationalities. So I'd expect this would apply in that case because it's not direct related to what you think of as their normal church activities. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
It certainly could be. I mean, this is something that would have to be interpreted in individual instances. But it certainly could be the case that if there's a commercial activity and they're doing this for a profit, this is a business that they're running, and it's not related to their primary purpose, then they would not be allowed to discriminate. But if it was, this is just a hypothetical, but if it was a charitable, if they were doing it for free or something like that, then I think they probably would be allowed to discriminate because then there's a closer connection to the purpose of the religious institution. So that's a good example.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
We have Senator Westland here. I'm going to give Senator Westland a minute to or so to make a statement here before we get into our other panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be brief. I understand there are many people that want to testify, so I appreciate you being able to bring me forward. And also thank you and the entire committee for hearing this most important bill. I think the way to sum up my testimony is just to point out the obvious that thoughts, perceptions, and attitudes change. I think we see this, it's evidenced greatly in the civil rights movement and discussions of back then, can you legislate morality? And I think the question that is answered very well, and it's not just morality, it's thoughts, perceptions, and attitudes. I don't think this is said any better than how Schopenhauer once described it of the three stages of truth. The first is that it is considered absolutely outrageous. The second is that it is vigorously and vociferously attacked. And the third is that that truth is commonly accepted as always being true. I'm here obviously in strong and passionate support of Senate Bill 2. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and as I have violated the first protocol of public testimony, I failed to identify myself, so I am Senator Ben Westland of District 27.
I forgot to interrupt you, Senator Westland. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
The last panel finished 5 minutes early, so what I'm going to do is we have someone signed up for the proponents who might be uniquely qualified to address the religious exemption issue, so I'm going to call him up, and then when the opponents come up, if you finish early, you will also have the opportunity to have your other people come up and fill the time available. So I'd like to call Charles Hinkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, and members of the committee. I have prepared some testimony that's being distributed to you now. I first testified in support of a bill like this in 1973. I couldn't find my 1973 testimony, but I do have my 1977 testimony, and I attached it to this today. If this legislature had acted in 1977, it would have been the first. You would have been a trailblazer. You're no longer a trailblazer. There are 17 states ahead of us now, and after I won't be here in another 30 years, so I hope that this is the session in which these efforts now in their 35th year will achieve success. Senator Beyer asked about ORS 236-380. I think that's the section that is being repealed. If I have that number right, that was Measure 8 in the 1988 election that put that on the ballot or in the statute books, and the Oregon Court of Appeals declared it unconstitutional in a case called Merrick against a Board of Higher Education in 1992. So it has been a dead letter ever since 1992, and as a matter of housekeeping, statutes that are unconstitutional shouldn't be on the books. But I think your reading of it, Senator Beyer, was correct. The double negative, when it says no state official shall prohibit the taking of discriminatory action, what that did was affirmatively allow state officials to take discriminatory action against persons on the basis of their sexual orientation, and that's what was declared unconstitutional. So that statute, as I said, is a dead letter. Now, with respect to the religious exemption, that is really the subject of most of my prepared statement in the first two pages, where I quoted and cited a number of laws in a variety of areas, tax, labor, tort law, drug laws, where state and federal statutes do use the phrase bona fide church or bona fide religious belief or bona fide religious tenet, and the courts deal with this all the time. Courts have to decide for tax purposes what is a bona fide church, because taxes, you know, churches get all kinds of exemptions. In the labor laws, an employee is not ever required by state statute, is not required to pay union dues if the employee has an objection based on bona fide religious tenets. That's part of Oregon statutes right now, and I cite a number of other examples to that effect. So the religious exemption that is here in Senate Bill 2 in Section 3, subsections 4 and 5 is a typical religious exemption that you find in many kinds of statutes. It is found as far as I know, the similar non-discrimination statutes all around the country. It has been applied by the courts to protect, for example, Billy Graham Ministries in the state of Minnesota. There was a case involving them. In other words, they were not bound by the statute there. And it comes up, you know, all the time in federal and state courts in terms of military exemptions, conscientious objection, exemptions from these labor laws that I mentioned, and in a variety of other contexts. So this is common grist for the judicial mill to decide what is a bona fide religious belief, what is a bona fide church. It occurs all the time, and there's nothing unusual about it.
Thank you. Senator Beyer, did that address your issue?
Cleared up some, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Yeah. Senator Walker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. I'm confused about this a little bit, because in your testimony here, your written testimony, you said that Oregon's employment discrimination laws already contain a comprehensive exemption for churches and other sectarian religious institutions. My confusion is that we have 9 tribal governments in Oregon, and they're exempt from Oregon law because they're a sovereign nation. We can't pass laws on a sovereign nation. But why are we giving exemptions to religious institutions from Oregon law that applies to everyone else? They're not sovereign nations unless they think they own God. So explain that one to me.
Well, in large measure, I think, Senator Walker, the exemptions that are in statutes for religious organizations are based on constitutional considerations, the free exercise of religion. At one level, I would suggest to you that these kinds of statutory exemptions are unnecessary, because churches already have constitutional protections against discrimination laws. That is to say, Meyer and Frank or Fred Meyer or Tektronix cannot discriminate against a Methodist when they hire a janitor or a CEO, but the Roman Catholic Church can discriminate against a Methodist when they're going to decide what priest is going to function as the priest of St. Mary's of the Valley. You know, there's a freedom of religion principle in our Constitution that says that legislatures cannot impose non-discrimination measures on bona fide religious organizations for those employment positions that are genuinely part of the religious institution. The question arises in the constitutional area, and frankly in the statutory area too, is, you know, maybe way out there at the fringes, you have to decide whether or not A, the organization really is religious, and B, if it is the position for which it's hiring someone a religious position. Let me give you an example. The Church of Latter-day Saints in Utah used to own the biggest department store in Utah. I don't know if it still does or not, but the Salt Lake version of Macy's was owned by the Mormon Church. Could they say, we're not going to hire a clerk to sell men's socks if that clerk is not a member of the LDS Church? I don't think so. That's why that second section is in here, Senator Beyer, at the bottom of that page. You have to have some kind of a connection with the primary purpose of the church. There was a famous case, a tax case 50 years ago in the federal courts involving not a religious issue, but a tax issue that had raised similar considerations. New York University, NYU, gets a tax exemption. It's a private nonprofit organization. Someone gave it a macaroni factory. Could it then claim all of the income in that macaroni factory, which was now owned lock, stock, and barrel by NYU, could they claim a tax exemption for the receipts from that? And the court said no. Just because you're owned by a nonprofit organization doesn't mean that your activity falls within the nonprofit organization principle. And the same thing is true here. If my church goes out and buys a macaroni factory, we're still going to have to pay taxes on the income of that macaroni factory, and we should not be permitted to hire only members of that church to make the noodles. But we are certainly entitled by the Constitution and by statute to hire only members of our denomination to preach in our pulpit. So I think the basic answer to your question is that these exemptions from employment discrimination laws exist at the federal level for religious institutions as a matter of statute. They exist in every employment discrimination, forget sexual orientation. In any employment discrimination statute in the country, there is a religious exemption because you don't want to force the Baptist Church to hire a Methodist to preach for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hingo. I know you're well-versed in the Constitution, and I appreciate that. It's clear that those exemptions are quite limited.
Oh, yes. However. I would agree with that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony. Okay. Now we will move into the opponents, Nick Graham and Roger Martin. And if there is time left over from this panel, we will fill it with other people who are signed up in opposition.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nick Graham. I'm with the Oregon Family Council, Madam Chair and Committee. The Oregon Family Council represents approximately 40,000 active individual supporters and nearly 2,000 Oregon churches. I want to thank you for allowing Oregon Family Council this opportunity to communicate our concerns with Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500. As an organization, we have a number of concerns with both of these bills, and we're confident that many Oregonians also share those concerns. I'll make an effort to express these concerns concisely as possible. I'm going to take a fairly linear approach and kind of just walk through a few of the sections that are of greatest concern to us. The first concern is just simply in the definition of sexual orientation. I know we've described, or the previous panel has described quite a bit, using terms such as gay and lesbian, but we want to be clear as well as we look into this and the effects of this legislation across the board that the term gender identity is also included, as well as bisexuality and heterosexuality, of course, as well. Specifically, though, in terms of the use of the term gender identity, this definition of sexual orientation, by which the courts will ultimately determine whether an individual, church, school, business, or place of public accommodation is guilty of discrimination, this definition is unnecessarily vague, making compliance more difficult and the intention of the legislature unclear. Furthermore, it opens the door for widespread abuse. And I'm specifically referencing phrases such as actual or perceived and identity, appearance, expression, or behavior. The vagueness is especially troubling in the context of public accommodation. Public areas such as malls, movie theaters, swimming pools, fitness facilities, hotels, and public schools all contain private gender-specific areas. With the current definition, these private gender-specific areas would have to be remodeled to accommodate transgender individuals. The other alternative, of course, would be to put citizens, clients, customers, etc., in the uncomfortable position of sharing these facilities with people who they may only be expressing or behaving as the opposite sex. Literally, and again, this would be a more extreme example, obviously, but literally, the way the law reads, any man could put on a skirt and walk into a lady's shower facility. And again, it's an extreme example, but we recognize it's not the intent of the legislation, obviously. But without a clear, more definitive definition of gender identity, this kind of behavior would be protected by Oregon law. That's all I have on sexual orientation in terms of the definition. Another concern we have deals with, in the case of litigation, sections 12 and 14 describe how defendants, prevailing defendants, would recoup their legal fees. And the way that the section reads right now is that the court may award reasonable attorney fees and expert witness fees incurred by a defendant who prevails only if the court determines that the plaintiff had no objectively reasonable basis for asserting a claim. In the case of gender, race, age, physical disability, an employer or other prospective defendant in a discrimination lawsuit can clearly see the protective traits. Sexual orientation, however, is not discernible. I, for instance, would not know whether someone is gay or lesbian if I was to look at them. Therefore, an employer who terminates or declines to hire a gay or lesbian person is open to the expense of a discrimination lawsuit in spite of the fact that he or she had absolutely no awareness of the employee or applicant's sexual orientation. If the business loses the suit, the plaintiff is guaranteed compensation for legal fees, no matter what. However, if the business prevails, the court must determine whether there was an objectively reasonable basis for the claim. In other words, the court would have to determine that the suit was frivolous, or else the defendant is left owing thousands in legal fees, having done nothing wrong. One might argue that the dozen or so municipalities already having similar laws, you know, that the sky hasn't fallen. We actually heard that phrase mentioned earlier. We'd argue this is actually a fact that demonstrates that there's very little evidence for discrimination based upon sexual orientation. And again, looking at the broad scope of the anecdotal evidence we've heard. This legislation, on the other hand, would set a new precedent for enforcement, and we find the lack of protection for defendants problematic. And also, I might add, too, that in terms of rural Oregon, there's a great deal of concern around rural Oregon that this legislation, of course, is going to affect them. And we believe that it would be a more appropriate manner to allow local municipalities, cities, counties to determine these laws. And so that's really what, you know, we believe that rural Oregon and other areas that haven't developed this legislation yet, you know, have done so for a reason. And in their due time, if they feel it appropriate, then they can have the opportunity to do that. Next, I'd like to speak on the affirmative action inclusions amongst state agencies. Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500 both call for the establishment of procedures to provide for affirmative action to seek out underutilized members of protected minorities in public employment. So the legislation does require state agencies to use affirmative action measures for underutilized members of protected minorities. This requirement is greatly troubling. To begin, enforcement of this provision would require public employees to declare their sexual orientation, whether heterosexual, gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. Again, how will state agencies know if they're fulfilling their requirements if they are not asking that information? This appears to us to be an intrusive invasion into an employee's private life. This affirmative action requirement becomes even more alarming in the realm of public education, as school districts statewide would need to fully examine their utilization of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender teachers and administrators. That actually leads me into the next part on public education, our concerns there. The two sections of Senate Bill 2 that specifically speak to public education and to the requirement for educational practices statewide to include on an equal level education relating to sexual orientation. Section 2 of the bill states that the Legislative Assembly intends by this chapter to provide a program of public education calculated to eliminate attitudes upon which practices of discrimination based on, and you know, the whole list of protected classes, including sexual orientation, are based. Proponents have made the case that this bill does not address curriculum. However, we don't see how legally requiring a program of public education to eliminate attitudes can be completed without taking this message into classrooms, assemblies, cafeterias, after-school activities, etc. Section 29 also states that, that's Section 29 in Senate Bill 2. I don't have the listed section for Senate Bill 500. I think it is different. States that a person may not be subjected to discrimination in any public, elementary, secondary, or community college, education, program, or service, school, or inter-school activity. Section 29 defines discrimination in the following way. Any act that is unreasonably differentiates treatment, intended or unintended, or any act that is fair in form but discriminatory in operation, either of which is based on sexual orientation. It can logically be argued that if one student in a classroom has gay parents and his or her family arrangement is not represented equally in classroom books, this student is being unreasonably differentiated against. Even though this differentiation is totally unintended, the school would still be guilty of discrimination. To avoid discrimination, would not the superintendent of public instruction mandate changes in our education system, textbooks, and teachers, so there is no differentiation of gay students or students with gay parents from the rest of the students? In an attempt to satisfy some of the public concerns with gender identity, the bill states discrimination does not include enforcement of an otherwise valid dress code or policy as long as the code or policy provides on a case-by-case basis for reasonable accommodation of an individual based on the health and safety needs of the individual. This language seems to invite lawsuits. And when a lawsuit is brought forth, the courts are put in the troubling position of deciding what is a reasonable accommodation for allowing a student to violate a dress code policy. Certainly, we can trust local school districts to establish acceptable dress codes, so let the exemptions simply state that the discrimination does not include enforcement of an otherwise valid dress code policy, period. Lastly, I'd like to touch on the religious liberties issue, which, of course, we've discussed at length already. And we'll have people that can actually speak more directly to this and at greater length, because it is our primary concern with the legislation, and that'll take place in the evening hearing. Lastly, our strongest concern comes in the area of what has been referred to as the religious exemption found in Section 3 of Senate Bill 2, Subsection 4 states, and we've heard this already today, nothing in this chapter prohibits a bona fide church or sectarian religious institution from taking any action with respect to employment, housing, or the use of facilities based on a bona fide religious belief about sexual orientation. Now, again, it looks like that would make sense. However, then there is the caveat in subsection 4 of this section, which applies only if the employment, housing, or the use of the facilities is closely connected with or related to the primary purposes of the church or institution and is not connected with a commercial or business activity that has no necessary relationship to the church or institution or to its primary purpose. In brief, what this is doing is it's actually ultimately, when these statutes are looked at, they're looked at by courts and by judges. And ultimately, what would have to be found by a judge is the judge would have to then determine for a given religious organization or a church what is the church's primary purpose. And ultimately, that would have to be determined before the determination could be made as to whether or not the position in question is closely connected with and whether or not, I'll just leave it at that, that essentially they would then have to determine whether that position is closely connected with. And so that brings to bear a great commingling of church and state, ultimately. And not only in churches, but again, sectarian religious organizations, and I might mention non-sectarian religious organizations, which would include, you know, gospel missions and things of that nature, faith-based charitable organizations, which are not included in this exemption whatsoever. Let's see. The governor's task force cautioned the legislature to give a wide berth to religious freedom. On page 20 of their report, they describe what is necessary in terms of a religious exemption, and this is how the report reads. The task force recommends that any legislation include an appropriate exemption for religious institutions. Freedom of religion, which is enshrined in both the United States and Oregon constitutions, must be respected. Accordingly, this legislation should not apply to activities of religious organizations. Perhaps the religious exemption in Section 2 is the crafter's interpretation of the task force recommendations, but we can assure you that a large portion of Oregon's religious community does not agree with that. These concerns have been repeatedly expressed dating back to Senate Bill 1000. On this point, and it really is absolutely paramount for our organization and the people that we represent around the state, that while it would not be our first desire, if our legal advisors do not feel that the religious exemption, ultimately what comes out of this building as a religious exemption, will not fully protect the freedoms of Oregon's houses of worship, private schools, religious institutions, and employers, we'll be compelled to refer the legislation directly to voters. I'll just conclude briefly by stating I've expressed a number of specific concerns with the bill. It's our deep desire that the committee will take these concerns into consideration. However, I must state for the record that ultimately we think the entire bill is unnecessary because we do not believe sexual orientation qualifies as a suspect class. As stated in the task force report, the United States Supreme Court has not found homosexuality to be a suspect class, and surely they have not found bisexuality or transgenderism to be a suspect class. In fact, the task force readily admits on page 9 that Tanner only refers to, Tanner being the appellate court decision, only refers to unmarried homosexual couples. And that, I'm sorry, I believe it actually refers to married heterosexual couples. That may be a typo. And that the Oregon appellate court took a step further than the United States Supreme Court. In 2005, the Fair Housing Council of Oregon reported that they had investigated just 11 cases from individuals in 2003 and 2004 that reported they'd heard of a landlord who wouldn't rent to a same-sex couple. In January 2005, Boley reported that just 5 cases out of a total of 144, and I know the figure of roughly 300 came from Mr. Gardner earlier, of those 144 cases, allegations made, 5 cases contained in 5 years contained enough evidence of discrimination to be substantiated. That's one case per year. Again, one case too many, but at the same time, we have to look at the breadth of what we're talking about. Is it wise to ignore legal precedent, empirical data, statistics from Oregon, and make such a significant change in public policy based primarily on anecdotal evidence? One passage from the governor's task force conclusion found on page 17 of their report perhaps provides some insight. This statement seems to us to indicate a troubling underlying intent of the proponents of this legislation, which is often ignored as these issues are communicated to the general public. The statement was actually made earlier by Senator Westland that you cannot legislate morality, and he even mentioned thoughts and attitudes. However, the intent of this legislation actually seeks out the legislation of thoughts and attitudes. And to validate what I've just said, I'd like to read in the concluding areas of the task force conclusions. It states, true equality will require attitudinal evolution. Adoption of the task force's recommendations for law changes in Oregon will be just one step forward towards great societal change and acceptance. Legislative action, however, is an essential step. Our laws reflect our values and aspirations. Perhaps more importantly, they affect our behavior. As the well-renowned psychiatrist William Glasser noted, if you want to change attitudes, start with a change in behavior. The great societal changes legislation such as Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500 hope to usher in go far beyond fair and humane treatment of all Oregonians. It is the rare Oregonian who believes that any person should be denied employment, housing, or other essential civil rights based on their sexual orientation. Our organization included in that, or our organization as well, does not agree that that should be the case. And as this and other testimony has indicated, there's little evidence this kind of discrimination exists in Oregon. But these two bills go much further. They put those who, for deeply held religious or personal convictions, cannot condone the gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender lifestyle to be suspect of discrimination simply because of their beliefs. It gives them the feeling that their beliefs and philosophy are contrary to the laws of this state. Furthermore, this legislation gives credence to proponents of this legislation to label opponents, such as our organization, as hate groups and bigots. We know because Oregon Family Council has been the recipient of those labels by the strongest proponents of this legislation, even in the last few weeks. And I'd just like to end there. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazanski, we're going to hold questions until the panel's finished.
Madam Chair, my name is Roger Martin. I represent the Oregon Catholic Conference. I'm listed, or you have got me listed as an opponent. I'm here more to question and to explore further the religious clause. I appreciate very much the committee, the Governor's Committee, and you, Madam Chair, have put that religious exemption in the bill. And I just want to make sure, and I appreciate the questions Senator Beyer raised, I want to make sure that that, in fact, does give the exemption that we need. The Catholic Church does not believe in discrimination, does not practice discrimination, perhaps has in the past, but is trying very hard to correct those things in the past. The reason we're very concerned about it is you're going to change, with the passage of this legislation, some major provisions in the employment and other laws of the state, which often lead to litigation. I just want to use one example. In 1991, this committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired then by Senator Joyce Cohen, passed a bill that did away with the statute of limitations on crimes against young people. Actually, it was sexual crimes altogether, based on a theory that, interestingly, was probably refuted within a couple of years. But that one passage, taking the statute of limitations off, ended up by the Catholic Church, the Portland Archdiocese, going into bankruptcy over a myriad of lawsuits that were filed. Many of those lawsuits were probably very valid, some probably questionable. But the end result was based on an action, and it was not intended for that purpose. The request to change the statute of limitations in 1991 was at the request of some women's groups who wanted to protect women who had been sexually abused in the past. It had nothing to do with what it ended up, but it opened up a new avenue. The Catholic Church does not want to be dictated to as to who it can employ, especially in sensitive areas like the schools that we teach around the state. We're also very concerned that we be able to make decisions as to who can attend places like Mount Angel Seminary. And if this exemption covers that, then we don't have an argument with it. I just want to raise that question. I appreciate Senator Beyer making those questions too, just so we can find out for sure that we are protected, which is something that we need. And I appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Now we'll take questions for this panel. Senator Pazanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Graham, I've got two, maybe three questions for you. The first one is, based on your presentation and the number of concerns and alerts that you've raised us to, I assume that you in your capacity have looked at the other 17 states that already have some type of protection. And could you please tell us in what which of those 17 states have, let's say, run amok as to the concerns that you have raised here in your letter or your testimony?
Actually, Senator Burdick, Senator Pazanski, I don't actually have, I couldn't answer that question. I'm not certain as to the level of these concerns being dictated, nor am I, do I understand how those statutes are actually put together and affect those laws.
Madam Chair, it looks like I'm going to have a fourth question.
Please.
Let me follow up on that. You're telling me and you're telling this committee that you've come up here, you've given us this testimony as to all these concerns that you're concerned with, mm-hmm. but you have done no research in any of the 17 states as to what, if anything, they've had problems with that could address any of these concerns that you've had that you could bring to us so we can consider in our deliberation.
Certainly. Actually, it does bring to mind a few things. If you would permit me to walk away for just a moment, I can grab them out of my... I actually have a few things that I can share with you.
A recent case in Massachusetts.
Just actually a ruling was made a few weeks ago about, it actually is about two parents, let's see, one of them by the last name of Parker, who had rejected to a book bag that his son brought home from kindergarten that included a book on diversity called Who's in the Family? Betrays same-sex couples as just a different type of family. The Worthlands objected, second family objected to a book their second grader was forced to read called King and King, in which one prince kisses another prince. Both families requested that they be alerted when homosexually themed material was to be taught. In his 38-page decision, Judge Wolf said parents, quote, have a fundamental right to raise their children, but the Constitution does not permit them to prescribe what those children will be taught. That's one example. Let's see if I...
Well, maybe instead of you going through that now, if you would provide us with whatever
Absolutely,
information
yes.
you have.
Yes, I'd be glad to.
Madam Chair, my next question, and Mr. Graham also for you, deals with the sections in an Oregon law found at ORS 166.155. This is the intimidation statutes. Oregon's already has acknowledged that individuals that are can, in fact, be intimidated based on their sexual orientation. I heard in your testimony that you didn't think that this was, let's say, a grave enough situation to warrant any type of protection in the area of employment or accommodations. And I guess I wanted to clarify or get you to please clarify for us your position as to whether or not Oregon should have on the books intimidation in the second degree as well as intimidation in the first degree as it pertains to protecting individuals based on their sexual orientation.
Well, I definitely would not know what our position on that bill was at the time that legislation was passed. I do think that, and if I might ask, I'm not certain as to how sexual orientation is defined in that particular section of law. Not that that's necessarily pertinent as much as the goal behind the legislation. We as an organization, we work as hard as we can to provide as much information to the Legislative Assembly or to voters to express our concerns with legislation. We're thrilled, by the way, that this is in a public process and that these issues are before the Legislative Assembly. We respect that and we are happy to be here and provide that information. I think the once Legislative Assembly finds that, and obviously in this case, the state of Oregon I don't really exactly know how to answer that question, to be honest with you.
Fair enough. One last question, Madam Chair. Let me just follow up on the intimidation. As a prosecutor, I've prosecuted numerous cases where individuals were charged with intimidation because they had a perception that the person they were attacking were gay or lesbian. Do you believe an individual who says their religious beliefs do not accept homosexuality should not be held accountable for attacking another individual based on that perception?
I absolutely believe that they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Based on that sexual orientation?
If I believe people should be prosecuted for attacking anyone. And I think the laws of our state protect anyone from being physically attacked in any way, regardless of the reasoning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Graham, I have one question for you, if you would. I've read your materials as you went along, but the comment you made in your testimony is not anywhere in your written testimony, so I need you to sort of elaborate a little bit.
Sure.
You made the comment, this bill is going to impact rural Oregon. I don't know what you mean by that. Can you share that with me, please?
Certainly. As it's been mentioned, there are a dozen municipalities around the state that have various forms of this legislation currently on the books. There are obviously many municipalities around the state that do not. And by passing this legislation, we're assuming that all of those municipalities are perfectly happy to have that legislation as part of their protocols. We believe that certain public policy is better left to be dealt with at the local level, and that's our position. And so clearly there have been more and more as the years go, more and more municipalities that have undertaken this discussion and have passed this legislation. And, you know, we assume that that will continue. But again, it does affect, you know, local communities, how this legislation is actually prosecuted. I'm not right now, in terms of employment, those issues are dealt with in the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I couldn't tell you in each municipality how their particular rules are set up in terms of how that's prosecuted and potential litigation, et cetera, that takes place from that. But we believe that it's the duty of the local municipalities to address these concerns as a you know, as it pertains to their area. And
question, Madam Chair, is thank you. Is Commissioner Dan Gardner, in his written testimony, indicated there were several communities that had passed legislation prohibiting discrimination on sexual orientation and or gender identity. Ashland, Beaverton, Bend, Corvallis, Eugene, Lake Oswego, Lincoln City, Portland, and Salem. The last sentence after that says, in addition, Wasco County will be voting on a similar ordinance next month. Would you consider Wasco County to be rural Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I would definitely agree that Wasco County would be considered rural Oregon.
Thank you.
However,
thank you.
I cannot further answer your question, okay. Senator Walker.
All right. Thank you. Senator Vakian.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you being gracious enough to let us non-committee members sit with you at the dais and ask a couple questions. And I have just a couple, if you don't mind. And I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Nick Graham.
Nick Graham. Mr. Graham, I'm assuming from your testimony that your organization would rather the bill not pass. Am I correct about that?
Yes, you are.
And I think I heard you right towards the end of your testimony when you said that the Family Council believes that no person should be denied employment, housing, or other essential civil rights based on their sexual orientation. Did I hear you right?
We don't believe that that should be the basis for which someone chooses to do that, no.
Well, what I'm curious about then, and I want to give you a chance to clarify the record if you need to, is that if this bill does not pass, that is exactly what the law will continue to be in Oregon. It will be lawful for an employer to fire somebody because they're gay, or for a landlord to evict somebody from their apartment solely because they're gay. And given your organization's opinion, I'm curious why that doesn't cause your organization some great concern.
Well, I believe what Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, Senator Vakian, we don't necessarily believe that, and again, there are aspects of this bill that are less concerning to us than others. We don't believe that employers, and let me back up just a moment. The concerns that I've laid out in this legislation are details within the legislation in terms of how this legislation is actually carried forward. It is not necessarily our concern that we prevent the protection of gay and lesbian families from being able to live their lives just as anybody else would be able to live their lives. Our concern is the effects of how this legislation is implemented, and both in through litigation, through placing employers with unnecessary risk for litigation, how this legislation is implemented in the public school system, how it affects, of course, churches and religious organizations. Those are the concerns that we have.
Let me, if I may, make sure that I understood what you just said, because I think it's very important. Your organization is not so concerned with whether the bill passes or not. You're concerned about how it's implemented after that. You want it to be implemented in a fair way.
Well, and we don't have any control over how that legislation is implemented. And so our concerns lie in historical evidence, which, again, we can provide for the committee across the state, or across the country, rather. Our concern is in terms of how the legislation is phrased and some of the potential ways in which that legislation is going to be implemented. We do not believe in discrimination as an organization. We don't believe that, you know, like I mentioned earlier, everyone should be free to live the life that they choose to live, in the same sense that everyone should be free to believe the way that they believe and carry the same philosophies that they carry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You stated that you would have more people or somebody here this afternoon for the hearing. Is that to deal specifically with the, whether or not the religious, excuse me, religious exemption in Section 3 is what you consider adequate?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, that's correct. We're going to have two other representatives. Both are attorneys. One is also a church business administrator, and they're prepared to give this committee testimony to that effect in broader detail.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Bates?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Graham, I'm going to go back to a question that Senator Brzozinski asked you. We're in an unusual situation in the state that we've actually tried this to a certain degree in many municipalities in different areas of the state, and I can't give you the actual information, so maybe you can give it to me. In Ashland and other areas that I'm familiar with, I know of no significant burden on any municipalities or church groups in implementing these laws. They've been in place and they've worked. I have many members of our community and friends of mine who had active discrimination against them until these laws were passed. They've made a significant difference, not only from the point of view of those individuals, but changing public attitudes about sexual orientation. Can you give us any instances in the state of Oregon where there has been difficulty because of laws similar to this?
There's a case, and I'm not certain as to its current status, actually in Eugene, in the case of a, the suit names the school principal, Dimebert, and St. Mary Catholic Church, and it seeks $50,000 for the daughter. The case essentially is that the school declined, the school declined enrollment to the girl because her parents were lesbians and their relationship was opposed to Vatican teachings and would be too confusing for other children their parents, the suit alleges. This is from a Registered Art article. The suit sought $50,000 for the girl's loss of an educational opportunity and up to $500,000 for non-economic damages. So that would be one case. But again, I'm not certain as to how each of these municipalities have written into their governing documents how these cases are dealt with when they do arise. What the process in which bully takes to, solve the problems when they do come up. I believe it was a Statesman Journal article back in 2005, just prior to the Senate Bill 1000 discussions, that I mentioned in my testimony that stated of 144 cases, alleged cases presented to bully over a 5-year period of time five of them actually had substantial evidence. Again, in the context of, as I mentioned, with the way in which prevailing defendants are given the opportunity to redeem their legal fees, they're given the opportunity, but then the bill states that unless there's a reasonable basis for the claim. And those 139 employers who there was no, who were not found to be guilty, if those 139 cases were taken to litigation, would those 139 employers actually receive the compensation for the attorney's fees they've incurred? And that, those are the concerns that we have with this legislation.
Okay. I think we'll thank this panel. And what we're going to do now, we're running short of time, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take two more panels of three for proponents, opponents, and then three each at 2 minutes apiece, if you could limit your testimony to that. And then I will move into one pro, one con until we get through as many people as we can. Now, if you are here, especially if you're from some distance and you absolutely cannot come back tonight, if you would get a message to the clerk and we will try to accommodate you. So I will call Julia Brim Edwards and Linda Saul Olshausen and Rebecca Groves. Come up.
Hello, my name is Becky Groves.
You need to put the microphone in front of you.
Put the mic. There you go.
Hello, my name is Becky Groves, and I live in Prineville. I have three beautiful children, one of whom is gay. I'm here today to ask you to support Senate Bill 2, which would ban discrimination based on sexual orientation statewide. My son Adam is now almost 23 years old. He is currently working as a licensed massage therapist and manager of a local health food store in Prineville. When Adam was 19 years old, he experienced a situation where he was discriminated against based on his sexual orientation. In our hometown of Prineville, there is a family who owns several businesses. My son worked at one of those businesses, Taco Time Restaurant, for approximately 2 years. It was his first job. He was an outstanding employee there and got promoted to supervisor after only a few months on the job. The manager there gave him a huge amount of responsibility and constantly spoke highly of his work abilities. After a few years, Adam chose to apply for a job in a hotel that this same family owned. At about this same time, he also came out as gay. When the manager found out that he was gay, she got very angry. She told the assistant manager at Taco Time that they would have none of that here. She said she was going to talk to the manager of the hotel and tell her not to hire Adam for the position at the hotel. Fortunately, the assistant manager at Taco Time was friendly with Adam, and she told him what their boss was about to do. He went to the manager of the hotel and told her outright that he was gay and that his boss had found out about it and she was going to try and stop him from becoming employed at the hotel. Fortunately for Adam, the manager at the hotel was not at all concerned about the fact that Adam was gay, and she knew Adam was an outstanding employee at Taco Time. She spoke with the owners, told them Adam was gay, and neither of them had a problem with hiring him. Adam was lucky. He had people in the community who knew him and knew his work ethic and overcame this problem himself without having to take any legal action. But many others are not so lucky. Sadly, there are people in our society who choose to look at a person's sexual orientation above their credentials as for a job. This is why it is so important to have one consistent statewide law against this kind of discrimination. This is especially important for families like ours who live in an area not covered by a city or county law. Please give your support to Senate Bill 2 to ensure that my son and other good people like him are protected no matter where they live in Oregon. Thank you for listening. I appreciate your time.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and committee members and non-committee members. We have some testimony. It's kind of a joint testimony between Linda and I that's being passed around. I'm Julia Brim Edwards, Nike's State and Public Affairs Director, and I'm here with Linda Saw Olshausen, Senior Manager for Global Diversity and Inclusion. I'm going to speak briefly about our presence here in Oregon and support for Senate Bill 2, and Linda's going to provide the diversity and inclusion framework at Nike. Diversity and inclusion are an important workplace issue for Nike, its employees, and other employers, so we're appreciative of the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 2. Nike employs about 6,900 people here in Oregon, our global headquarters state, and about 27,000 worldwide. in one form or another. We have a presence in just about every state in the U.S. and in about 150 countries around the globe. Nike was founded by Oregonians and is the state's only Fortune 500 company, and we have an estimated $2 billion annual economic impact on the state's economy. Nike has a record of leadership both in the federal and state level in support of employment diversity and non-discrimination based on sexual orientation.
Can I interrupt you for half a second? We have your written testimony. If you could just summarize.
Okay. So, for example, in 1994, we began to offer health benefits to permanent partners for our employees, and we now offer a full range of benefits to permanent partners, including Family Medical Leave Act, health insurance for dependent children, and the right to use facilities, the employee store, and other benefits that are extended to opposite-sex married partners. Last year, we were a major part of the Employer Coalition in Washington State and provided critical assistance in the adoption of Washington's non-discrimination legislation.
I am Linda Saul Olshausen. At the core of our corporate ethics, we believe that we are a company that's comprised of a vast array of talent, ideas, motivation, and spirit. And diversity at Nike is about respecting the differences, leveraging our strengths, and maximizing opportunity for all. Our commitment to diversity, inclusion, and non-discrimination is evident corporate-wide. A matter of respect. That's our global anti-harassment and anti-discrimination policy. It elevates Nike's global standards for acceptable workplace behavior beyond regulatory requirements. Nike does not tolerate discrimination or harassment based on, among other things, one's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. We also extend this expectation to conduct by visitors, customers, and vendors with our employees. We firmly believe that diversity drives innovation, and it's been our experience that high-performing teams really thrive in an inclusive workplace environment. And to that end, we try to maximize both the individual and the collective potential so that we can really leverage diversity as a competitive advantage for us. Our global diversity initiative really centers around creating that fair, equitable, diverse, and inclusive environment, so that we are all optimized and be able to contribute to our fullest potential. This isn't just the right thing to do, it's a smart business decision for us. And as previously referenced by Paul Kelly, it enables us to attract and retain the very best and the very brightest from around the world to come to our company. And public policies such as Senate Bill 2 that creates a statewide, consistent, non-discriminatory living and working environment will further enhance our ability to compete for top talent in the global marketplace.
Just in closing, Nike supports a strong state non-discrimination policies as they would extend a set of basic employment, housing, and public accommodation rights to Oregonians, including some of our employees. And I think it's important to note that we're not located in one of those entities that currently has a local non-discrimination ordinance. And certainly we have employees who live across the metro area. Some of them live in municipalities or counties that are covered, and some of them don't. So the benefit of a statewide policy versus a patchwork is very important for us as an employer, but also to our individual employees. And one of the Nike maxims is to do the right thing, which asks our employees to not look for things that make us different, but things that make us better. And we think passage of this bill would be better for our employees and better for the state of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Okay, now we'll take Charles Starr, Gordon Kelly, and Stanley Oakchurch, maybe. Stanley Church. Yeah, I just read the handwriting wrong. Mr. Starr, why don't you start out first?
Madam Chair, I'm Charles Starr, known to most of you, I think.
But Senator Starr, former Senator Starr, was vice chair of this committee last session. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I have some difficulty, I guess, very much with this bill. A foreign power years ago said the way we will conquer America is destroy its morals. We've been about that, seeing that happen in our country for many, many years. For the first time under the rule of law, this bill, Senate Bill 2, a small minority, economically affluent and politically powerful, would force their moral values upon the rest of us. They would force compliance in the workplace and subject vendors to retraining prisoner both. This has happened, unfortunately, in Pennsylvania, where two grandmothers who simply were doing a little street witnessing to their faith were arrested, tried, and convicted of hate crime against homosexuals. This bill requires that we begin a program of education in our public schools to make sure our little boys and girls understand how wholesome and acceptable this lifestyle or behavior really is. We should never recognize a class of people who are identified sexual orientation. They're identified only by the sexual practice that they engage in. To say that their sex acts are unhealthy or against nature would bring forth outright suppression of biblical truths and persecution of Christians. The bill identifies the church, or bona fide religion, primarily as an institution recognized by the state, usually as a corporation, a 501c3 most likely. But the biblical terms, the church is the bride of Christ, includes everyone who names Jesus as Lord and Savior. The passage of this bill is a frontal attack against those biblical beliefs of Christians. Fairness for homosexuals or sexual orientations seems very benign. We're giving a special right here where evidence is limited that any more than verbal abuse has been a serious problem. And that verbal abuse goes both ways. Extremely strong from the homosexual community to the believing Christian. Sodomy is still illegal in 22 states, I believe. Georgia law was upheld as constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1988 because of the compelling public health interest. Life expectancy among homosexuals is about 40 years. Population at large is in the mid-70s. Early on, the HIV AIDS was recognized as a homosexual disease, and latest statistics show that 65% of new infections are in that community. We have huge costs to our government from a loss of moral values. Broken families, children without fathers, increases of child abuse, rampant venereal disease, all result from loss of moral values. We shouldn't be legislating a downward spiral in our values. I would urge you to strongly consider voting against Senate Bill 2. Thank you, Madam Chair. Be glad to answer questions.
Thank you. We'll continue with the panel. Mr. Church, we have your written testimony, and there is not time to read it, so if you could summarize it, would be great. I'm looking at the wrong person.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Burdick and Vice Chairman Beyer and honorable Senate members. My name is Stanley Church, and the first paragraph just says why I'm here. I do believe that the community that is addressed in Senate Bill 2 has made many contributions to our nation and to human progress in the world. Nevertheless, my testimony is in opposition to the bill because I think that there are some things in it that need to be much more closely defined to protect various groups that I'm interested in. I'd like to emphasize my paragraph 3, religious education and business entities that are likely to be unduly affected by portions of Senate Bill 2. For example, church buildings generally have open doors through which they welcome all people for services, and restrooms are generally provided for the two well-established genders. But it looks like under Senate Bill 2 that if a well-known cross-dresser or transgender individual were to attempt to use a restroom that and a church member recognized it as such and were to attempt to restrain that person and direct them to the more appropriate one, a lawsuit could occur. And the churches that I'm associated with are generally small, independent, and really quite unable to withstand such lawsuits. Several of our schools, colleges, and universities in Oregon are closely affiliated with groups of churches. The one I'm most closely affiliated with is Corbin College. It's a standalone, independent university, very well supported by one group of churches. It is not a church. It's an educational institution. But it draws much financial support and many students from this one group of churches. And if it were challenged by someone who was seeking employment or who had been employed legally, it would be difficult for them to defend themselves. And if they said, okay, you're hired or you're admitted, then it is likely that a large portion of its financial support would be withdrawn. I think that there are several of these independent colleges in the state of Oregon, and the loss of these institutions would be severe to the state. Now, currently I teach part-time in a pre-kindergarten through 12th grade school. It also is independent. We are housed in a particular church, but it's an interdenominational school. And we're really scraping along. We are not a charity. We don't give away free education, but we're not for profit. And we could ill afford to offend our supporting people and our supporting churches by accepting someone who brought suit to us for alleged discrimination. And we couldn't stand the price of the lawsuit either. So I think for this reason, a considerable amount of close definition needs to be done by writers of this bill before I could support it. So for this reason, I stand in opposition to the bill. Are there any questions that I could answer for you, Senator?
Thank you. We'll wait till Mr. Kelly testifies. And you can see we're losing committee members. We all have 3 o'clock committees, so we need to limit you to 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And remaining committee members, I can't help but think of my religious faith, which has been persecuted.
Could you give your name, Mr. Kelly? Could you give your name for the record? Thank you.
Gordon Kelly, resident of Salem, Oregon. I was contacted by the Oregon Family Council, but I'm testifying more as a retired businessman and investor here in Salem, and I too have concerns about the bill as it stands. As I listen to the testimony and the questions, there seems to be a lot of confusion, a lot of opportunity for lawsuits, founded or unfounded. Win or lose, the business loses. There's just no possible way that we can win once we go to court, and for this reason, until it's further clarified, I guess I would be on the side of the other 33 states that do not have this legislation in current. So I would be in opposition to the bill as it stands. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the brevity of your testimony. Are there questions for this committee? Thank you. My apologies to all of you who didn't get a chance to testify. I saw a number of you signed up as having prepared testimony. Please give your testimony to our committee clerk. Unless you're able to come back at 5:30, you can either turn it in now or bring it back at 5:30. At 5:30, we will be reconvening this hearing in Hearing Room E, which is downstairs. And we will proceed accordingly. Close the hearing on, or recess the hearing on Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 500 until 5:30 this evening. And Senate Judiciary is in recess. Yeah, really.